Yeah, I was definitely apprehensive about it. And I can safely say it's the best thing I've ever done in my life, is like committing to this. Because it's just opened up so much more opportunity and more time to kind of like spend doing the things I actually really enjoy.
Hey, it's George, and welcome to the Call to Adventure podcast. We're on a mission to help create happier people and a healthier planet, so let's get after it. Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Call to Adventure podcast with me, George B. I hope you're all good, listeners and viewers. Remember that you can now head over to YouTube and see the video version of this if you're so inclined by searching Call to Adventure Podcast. Subscribe and turn on the notification bell if you want to get alerts when new episodes drop. It's great to see that things are opening up a bit after the most recent wave of Omicron has stabilised, which means that lots of our trips are back on, which is amazing. So I'm now heading out to France in February for some winter mountaineering, and there's still a couple of places left on a few of our courses. So if that floats your boat, head over to calltoadventure.uk. You can check out those trips, and just those that you know, there's the COVID guarantee, which means that you can change dates for free, move to a different trip, or just get your money back, no questions asked. So now on to today's show. We're chatting with Charlie Lowe and Dale Combley, two climbers with a passion for design and DIY, currently living full-time in a self-built caravan. They're the authors of the book, The Van Conversion Bible, which we'll link in the show notes, and have since launched Nomadic Energy, a campervan electrical system design service. So we'll get into the weeds of van conversions, which I know is a very popular topic amongst our community. So guys, thanks for coming on the show. How's it going?
Yeah, good, thank you.
Yeah, good.
So we normally kick off with a few quickfire questions. So given that there's two of you, we can just do first one on the buzzer. There's no buzzer, but you can just shout out the first answer, okay? There's three quick ones. So first one, sprinter or crafter?
Well, bias, but sprinter.
Because we live in one, so that one's easy. Yeah.
Easy breezy. One in the bag. Trad or sport?
Ooh. How long we got?
About an hour, actually.
We'll both say on the count of three.
Yeah, okay.
One, two, three. Trad.
Oh,
that was good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Surprising. I think it's interesting. I think Charlie's like come from a trad background. I've come from a sport background. We're kind of like finding some happy middle ground. So, well, apparently not now, actually. We're just trad.
But I guess you mentioned that you're out in Spain now. So lots of sport climbing now.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. We definitely spend probably the majority of our time sport climbing, I would say. But if we're in the UK, then I think we definitely favour trad, because the UK is definitely good for trad climbing.
Yeah, get fit, sport climbing, and then do some hard trad in the summer.
Yeah.
Yeah, very cool. Love it. Last one, coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Definitely coffee. Yeah, that one was easy too. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say we're like 90% coffeeers. There's a few people who randomly go for a tea. Some people are like white tea, black tea, pu'er tea we've had, so some real interesting ones. Nice. Yeah, but normally coffee. I was just a heavy coffee addict for many years, and I actually stopped. So I'm still coffee, even though I don't drink coffee anymore. Coffee just wins every time, but I can't drink it because I love it too much. And then you're on like the five a day, and then you can't get out of bed without it. So I definitely miss the coffee. Okay, cool. So quick fire questions done. Let's hit up some van conversion stuff. You really have written the van conversion Bible. I was going to say the Bible for van conversion, but that's exactly what it is. So it's something that I've wanted to do for some time. So I just want to pick your brain on all things van conversion, because I know lots of people will be listening thinking, this is really cool. I want to give it a go. I don't have any experience in it. So let's go from the top. So when somebody is thinking like, I want to do this, how should they think about which van to choose?
It's a very difficult, like definitive answer. You're going to get good vans, bad vans of every make. It very much depends on its kind of like its background and its history. I think looking at, I'm trying to remember now the name of the survey. There's a survey each year that kind of highlights the most reliable vans.
Yeah, it's almost like a bit of an index, isn't it?
Yes.
But yeah, that in terms of like make and model helps to highlight the kind of most reliable vans. But I think something that we always say is kind of planning. So if you start planning what you think you need in your van, so how much are you going to use it? Are you living in it? Are you just using it for weekends? Like, how much gear do you have? Then you'll start to get an idea of like how big a van you need as well. And that's obviously going to inform kind of what van to base it on. So I think instead of just choosing a van, it makes sense to plan out how much you think you'll need in there. And then based on that, you can start to think about what van to base it on.
Yeah, it sounds simple, but it is a very common mistake that we keep on coming across of people spending hundreds of hours converting a van, and then they've realized they can't really fit everything in it, or they've built something absolutely enormous and they can't go to the places they want to go to.
And then they end up starting again. Yeah. Which is not ideal.
Yeah, I like that. So don't think about the van first, like make the list of what you want to do with it and then find the van as like the second order to fit. But on the back of that, if people are thinking like, well, I've got my list, I'm not really sure now whether to go for like an extra long wheelbase, or can you really live in like a much smaller van, like a Relay is kind of medium size, but what would be your smaller, your medium and your larger, either recommendations or things that you'd look in those, or maybe even some that you'd stay away from that you're like, these are terrible, don't get one of those.
I think for the smaller vans, I think like your sort of classic VW Transporter is like a very safe bet. Obviously you can get smaller vans than that, but then you're not going to be able to like stretch out when you're sleeping. I think VW Transporters are like the starting point for kind of like being able to live and travel in some degree of comfort. Smaller than that is always a bit of a sort of compromise.
Yeah, I think in terms of medium vans, I know the Ford Transits are like fairly popular, and I think there's like pros and cons to that. It's like fairly easy to get parts, but then
more likely to break down.
Yeah. So yeah, pros and cons.
Yeah. And then I think larger, I think you're in the worlds of like Fiat Ducatos and Citroen Relays, which are essentially the same thing. And it's the same for the Sprinters and Crafters. Which are also very, very similar apart from the sort of engine difference.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it really comes down to kind of personal preference.
Yeah, I think the other thing is with the big vans, the Ducatos and similar vans have like much kind of boxier shape. So they tend to be much more flat-sided, whereas the Sprinters are a bit longer inside, but the walls taper in a lot more. So it kind of depends what you're wanting to do. If you're trying to get your bed across the van, then something like the Ducato makes sense because it's a little bit wider inside and you get a bit more kind of space across. Whereas if you are going for like a lengthwise bed, or you're maybe having like a bed that converts into seating, then it maybe makes more sense to go for the Sprinter, where you get a little bit more kind of length inside of it.
Yeah. And I should wait to ask this one, but I have to ask it because we've had so much discussion, like me and my girlfriend about, and lots of other people that we've talked about, beds in the van are probably one of the big things. So lots of people go for the sideways van. I'm 6 foot and I do like the idea of being able to spread out and not have to always lie diagonally. So what do you think about, have you got a definitive answer on this is the best way to do your bed, or at least some good tips?
Yeah, definitely got a good tip, and a good tip for, I suspect, the people that listen to the podcast. If you're into adventure and sports and you've got loads of kit, inevitably you need loads of boot space. And this was the main sort of driver for us putting the bed lengthways, because we've got so much climbing equipment and there's probably like 500-600 meters of rope in the boots and it all takes up a lot of space. I think for us, having it going across, you just don't get the same amount of space. I think whether if we wanted to sort of go across the van or not, we didn't really actually have a choice. We have to go lengthways to get everything in that we need.
Yeah, I think the other thing is, in terms of kind of like practicality, is Like if you go lengthways, for us, we've got just a normal double mattress from IKEA, and it's given enough space to make a kind of like bedside table that also has storage in to give us some extra storage. Whereas if you have your bed acrossways, then you very much need to use like every ounce of space. You'll probably need to chop a mattress down, and a lot of people will kind of eat into the insulation space in the walls to give themselves a bit of extra space, but it means that you end up with the space next to your bed not being very well insulated, which isn't ideal. So I think if you are going across, it's probably more suitable if you're on the shorter side. Like it wouldn't be a problem for me because I'm only 5'3", but if you're 6', it's probably not the way to be going.
Okay, cool. That's really, really useful. So I'm now thinking definitely going to go vertical bed. So I was right. But how big a van do you need to be able to accommodate that, given that you've still got to have your other stuff in the rest of the van?
So we've got a long wheelbase Sprinter. So there is an extra long version available, but they are sort of relatively rare. And I think we don't want to convert another van now because this is lovely and we want to kind of like enjoy traveling in it and that sort of thing. But I think if we were to do another, we'd probably do a medium wheelbase. So a little bit shorter, maybe half a metre shorter, but we could pretty much get away with the same layout.
Yeah. So at the moment we've kind of got like this big L-shaped kitchen. We've got like double seating kind of sat opposite each other so that you can sit at the table, and then we've got the bed. So I think you could definitely make the kitchen quite a bit shorter and shrink the seating down a little bit and still get away with having the same bed. And then there's like other options for having like seating that folds out more, and it all kind of depends on what layout you're doing. And also for us, our cab is enclosed, so we've built a bulkhead so that we don't see the front of the van, whereas for some people they'll keep that open and have swivel seats, and then that gives you a lot more room as well, so then you can kind of eat into the van a bit more with your bed if you're having swivel seats.
Yeah, I think the shorter the van gets, the better, or the better reasons you have to like open up the cab and have swivel seats, just because you're so limited on space anyway. Cutting off another meter at the front already with two seats there becomes harder and harder to justify. Really.
And why might you not want to open up the front?
So we had a couple of reasons for building the bulkhead and closing it off. One of them was just to make it feel kind of more like cozy and homely. So yeah, like when we're in the back of our van, it kind of feels like you're in a tiny little like apartment. There's nothing really that makes you feel like it's a van, like because it's fully cladded and you can't see any kind of like doors or this sort of thing. It feels really cozy. Whereas if you can see into the front, you don't quite have the same vibe. And it's also more cozy because it's warmer as well. It's like much better insulated having the cab. If you don't have the bulkhead, then you lose loads of heat through the front. So that's like another kind of good justification for doing it.
And conversely to that, it also gets hot a lot quicker as well. Both of those for us is kind of like quite important. Yeah. Like we're always traveling in areas where it's kind of it's like relatively cold in the shade, but will be like 15, 20 degrees outside. And leaving a car or a van in that sort of temperature in full sun all day does get quite hot.
Yeah.
I think it works really well for us blocking it off.
Yeah. Whereas for other people, the pros of having the extra space will outweigh the kind of negatives. So
yeah,
the nice thing about converting a van, what it normally comes back to is like, you can just do whatever you want. So you can open the cab up if that's what works for you. But equally, if it doesn't work for you, then you can close it off. So
yeah, you don't need to fall into the trap that you kind of like classic motorhome manufacturers have like had to go down. They're trying to satisfy absolutely everybody with one or two different designs, which, coming from a background of design and engineering, just doesn't work. You're going to satisfy a few people and kind of irritate the rest. And I think you can kind of see that because so many people are now converting vans.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, actually. And that isn't a kind of lens that I've thought about it through, like the fact that there's not much variety and not much customization. Because I always think, Like, it looks really cool when you convert a van, and I love the idea of doing it and like living in a space that you kind of made. But then when I see a mate of mine, he bought like a pretty old camper van, but like a proper old school one. And it is just really practical. Like, it looks like the least cool thing you've ever seen. But the bed's just right above the cab, and there's loads of space, and everything fits in there. And you'd be the least cool people on the campsite. But I do think, like, it's so practical. I hate how good it is, like, when I go in there. So, but like you say, maybe it's you don't get the option to think about, like, to fit it to your bespoke circumstances in the same way as like when you do a van conversion.
Yeah.
I think one of the interesting things is for our book that we ran a really, really big survey of people that have converted vans and people that wanted to convert vans. And we were delving into all sorts of areas. But one of the areas we were trying to understand was people's rationale for converting a van. And we kind of like assumed quite a lot of it would be cost as like the main driver. It's much, much cheaper to convert it yourself. But I think actually it was 83% of people were converting a van themselves as a pure personal preference. They wanted something that like exactly fitted their needs, essentially, rather than going down the sort of like formatted like motorhome route where you're kind of given.
So on that point, like, what about budget? How much should people be thinking, like, I need to have this much cash to, I guess it's a bit like how long's a piece of string, but I'm sure you can give me a bit more of kind of guidance of, if you're doing a medium build, then you probably need roughly this to this. Like, what's your kind of range of, if you wanted to, how much you're going to spend on, say, a Ducato that still kind of works, is, I don't know, maybe 40,000 miles. And then how much do you think you're going to spend on the actual conversion?
So when we wrote our book, we knew that this is the question. Well, this was the question we were asked the most when we finished our build. Yeah. And so we knew it was the question that people were asking the most, because ultimately people that want to do it want to know if it's possible. And so they want to know how much it's going to cost. But obviously it varies wildly based on the size of van that you're converting, and also the kind of level of finish that you're going to, like how high spec it is, how much time you're investing into doing it yourself versus if you're paying a professional to do different parts of it. As Dale kind of mentioned before, we ran a bunch of surveys. So one of the questions that we asked people was, how much did your conversion cost and how much did your van cost? So that we could kind of get a bit nerdy with it and create these graphs showing, like, for small, medium, large vans of different kind of spec, what the kind of price range was. So I can't quite remember off the top of my head, but we can start leafing through the book to get some of the numbers if you want.
Well, that's a good teaser. That's a good reason for people to buy the book. I mean, if you're thinking of doing this, I always find we're like taking on any new project, I always try and find one or two of like the definitive Bibles where they can just, somebody's gone through all the hard work and you can just learn from all of their hours. Like for regenerative agriculture, which I'm looking at getting into now, there's a guy called Richard Perkins, and he's done it for like 20 something years, and he's just written this like the Bible of like sustainable farming. And it's expensive for a book. It's like 80 quid, but you think in probably like a day you've saved that many hours of your it's so worth it. I think there's kind of something to working things out for yourself, but it's always good to have a bit of a guide. So if people want the in-depth graphs, and I guess your science and engineering background means that you've like, I loved it when I heard that you both came from that background, because I know that the kind of stuff that will be in the book and the way that you approached it, like, I think doing a survey is such a good idea and something that a lot of people don't do. And I think, is it right that you had like a thousand respondents or something? You had a lot of people respond.
It was well over a thousand. Yeah. I think close to 2,000 off the top of my head. Yeah.
But the reason that we did that was because we were really keen to approach it from kind of like a data-driven mindset. So instead of just writing about what we did and just saying like, this is how we did this and this is how we did that, we wanted to approach it from a kind of like, whatever you're wanting to do, whether you want to put a shower in your van, whether you want to convert a tiny van or a bus, like whatever you're doing, this is how to do it, and here's the science behind what we're saying, and here's the data to back up everything that we're saying, so that we're not just guessing things, but we're figuring them out and then presenting our findings, basically.
Yeah, love it. I'm going to buy it now. You've sold me. So on the kind of with the wider point of, if somebody's thinking about, they like the idea of this lifestyle, they want to go away, do some traveling, is DIY for everyone, or do you think some people should just outsource?
I think the outsource point is really interesting, because I think converting a van, you're building a tiny house, essentially. You're doing water, gas, electrics, carpentry. You're really touching on an incredibly broad range of DIY tasks. But I think crucially, you don't need to do all of them yourself. If there's something that particularly scares you, I mean, I think fitting windows and cutting a big hole in the side of your van is the one for most people that they outsource. Ironically, yeah. It's probably the easiest task.
Yeah.
really?
It is simple. It's just very daunting. But I think that's kind of my top tip, I'd say. If anyone is going to convert a van, is don't be afraid to ask for help. Or if you're really not comfortable with something, pay a professional to help. There's plenty of other jobs to be getting on with.
Yeah. So. And I think the other side of that is, especially for people who are maybe working in freelance jobs, then it might be that it makes more financial sense to pay someone to do a job that you don't feel comfortable with, if you can then just go and do the thing that you would normally do. So I think there's a bit of a balance of do it, for a lot of people, they just want to do everything so that they can say I converted this myself and I did everything.
Yeah.
But I also don't think it's a bad thing if there's one job that you're particularly not looking forward to, outsourcing that is probably sensible.
So we've had a few of your top tips. What about top mistakes for newbies or things to avoid?
I think one of them is something that we touched on before, which is getting so excited about doing it that you just start doing it. You don't plan, and then you'll probably just end up having a nightmare because you won't have half the things you need, or you might build something and then later on you realize that you haven't factored in something that you need or space for something, how to do something. There's such a big thing to be said for planning, even if you're not a planner by nature, just taking a step back and making sure that you've considered everything and you've thought about everything. And even just what am I working on next weekend, and making sure that you've ordered everything you need, because there's nothing more annoying than going to start working on the van and realizing that you don't have everything you need for that weekend. So yeah, that's definitely a good thing to do.
I think the other thing that we've noticed more recently, working within the electrical system side of camper vans, is people will basically crack on with the easy jobs. And I referenced earlier, doing windows and skylights and vents, you get quite a lot of progress quite quickly. So people tend to cover the top of the roof with vents and skylights. And then they think, right, now I need to do my electrics. And they've basically used all of their space on the roof, and they've got massive power requirements, and they've got room for a tiny solar panel. And fundamentally, it's just not compatible. It's not going to work. They just can't fit enough solar up there to meet their needs, essentially. And they're a bit scuppered then. There's only a few things that you can do to rectify it. And most of the time that is basically going to a campsite and plugging in somewhere. So that's definitely a really common mistake that we're seeing at the moment.
Yeah,
it's just not planning ahead enough, really.
Yeah, that highlights why it's worth planning more than one step in advance, because you might not think that you need to plan for something at the start, but then if you don't, you might get a few steps down and suddenly realise, oh no, I haven't factored in this thing that I should have done about 2 months ago.
Yeah, so. I think it basically created this exact problem, created the structure of most of our book, really.
Yeah.
I think particularly for me, coming from a design background and just having fallen into the trap tens of times myself and watched hundreds of people do the same and make those mistakes, we were really keen to set out a really solid, logical process that you can follow to just essentially reduce your risk of making a big expensive mistake.
You kind of touched on it there, but you've launched this nomadic energy business. So what exactly are you doing there?
So the reason that we launched Nomadic Energy, it kind of came off the back of the book a little bit. So when we did all these surveys, we found that the bit that people were most nervous about was the electrical system. It's also the most expensive part of most people's build. And it's quite easy to get it wrong, either to massively overspec your system and end up spending a lot more than you need to. Or if you underspec your system, then you essentially just need to rip it all out and start again. And because our backgrounds are in kind of physics and engineering, and we'd spent a lot of time researching around that area for the book, it kind of made sense for us to spend a bit more time reading into it and kind of help others with it. We felt like it was an area that we could help other people not make those mistakes and make sure that they had a system that kind of fit their needs exactly and provide them with a wiring diagram so that they wouldn't need to spend kind of hundreds of hours figuring it out themselves, because there's like so many different things to consider and it can be really confusing, especially if you're from a less technical background, because the actual installation process itself is very simple. The kind of the way that we've approached it is we've created these really detailed wiring diagrams and we've got like a little installation booklet that goes along with it, and it almost feels a bit like a IKEA instruction manual. So it's like step one, put this here, step two, and the idea is that if you're not technical at all, you can kind of just follow it as a bit of a step by step and it should be fairly easy. So yeah, I think we wanted to kind of help people who were maybe less technical, but also people who just didn't want to spend kind of hundreds of hours researching and trying to figure out every single component that they needed, or kind of just end up under or overspecing their systems. So that's what we kind of started working on once the book was finished. And it's been going for maybe like six or seven months now.
Yeah.
But yeah, the nice kind of side effect of doing that is that we've been able to quit our old jobs and it's now enabling us to live and travel on the road, because it's like our business that we run. So it means that we can kind of reply to people at 10 o'clock at night or on a Sunday or kind of whenever we feel most productive. But that allows us to kind of travel and live the lifestyle that we've wanted to live. So it's nice that by helping others, we've also been able to kind of help ourselves as well, I guess.
So now you've started on the digital nomad life. I think a lot of people love the idea of doing it. We mentioned just before the start of the call, but how long have you been kind of on the road and doing that? And what's the experience been so far?
We must be coming up for about 10 months in now, something like that. And it's been great. I think I was a little apprehensive before. I think I'm, despite doing some of the things that I do and some stupid things, I'm relatively cautious, particularly like financially and just like doing sort of like ticking all of the boxes that your parents kind of want you to tick. I've always been like
a good engineer.
Yeah, but basically, yeah, it's a very engineer's mindset, essentially. Yeah, I was definitely apprehensive about it. And I can safely say it's the best thing I've ever done in my life, is like committing to this, because it's just opened up so much more opportunity and more time to kind of like spend doing the things I actually really enjoy. I think that's what it's brought for us, really.
Yeah, because I mean, when we first set out converting the van, the plan always was that we were having like a year off in the van traveling, and then we come back again. And that was in part just because we both had full-time office jobs, and so there was kind of no way for it to be possible for it to be longer than that or feasible. So that was kind of the plan, and then kind of everything's fallen into place really nicely with kind of having written the book, and then off the back of that starting Nomadic Energy. It's all just kind of meant that what initially started as being a year off has just become our lives, I guess. Yeah. We kind of realized like fairly soon in that actually we can just keep doing this. If we're kind of running our own business, then why on earth would we go back to just sitting in our house doing that? We may as well just keep traveling to cool places and exploring and climbing and working with mountains out the window.
You mentioned that it kind of like fell into place, and I think it seems like a bit of a perfect storm with you guys. Like, you have great backgrounds for it, but I think some people will think like, I really want to do this, but I'm not sure how to think about what I could offer in terms of like making money online. Have you got any advice there? Any thoughts for people that don't come from like product engineering and physics backgrounds and doing, you know, a kind of relate? I guess it's taking your skills that you've got. It's not related to what you were doing before, is it? But it's kind of, it's naturally suited to your skill set. So have you got any thoughts on how people should think about if they are just like, I have no idea, but I'd love to do this?
I think so often, and I've definitely fallen into this trap in the past, you're busy sort of living your life, doing 9 hours a day in an office and commuting, and you don't actually have much time to really think and like come up with a new business idea or a new sort of direction for your kind of like career to go in. But when you move into a van, your living costs, just they're just an absolute fraction of what they previously were. So you haven't got that sort of pressure of paying rent or a mortgage to sort of worry about. So you can sustain living and traveling in a van for really quite a long time. And I think having that time is just the answer for coming up with, like, well, what your question is, really finding that thing that you can do. I think we never had any intention of starting Nomadic Energy until we were on the road, and we're just generally chatting about questions that we get from people, and we kept on getting questions and kept on getting questions. And it's like, oh, hang on. Maybe it's just been staring us in the face the whole time, and we can just commit to it. And because we basically have no overheads and we've got lots of time, we could apply it, and it's like, it's gone really well because of it. Whereas I think if we were trying to do that in our house and like going to work each day, you're always working on your little project when you're knackered, basically. You never have that like fresh time to think about it.
I think the other thing is that like what COVID's kind of shown us is that it is possible to do most jobs remotely. And I think a lot of companies have had to change the way that they work to facilitate that. And hopefully what that means is that's kind of like a positive thing that's come out of everything that's happened. And so many more companies are offering kind of remote roles now. So it's kind of, even if you don't have a particular skill set, I think there's so many different types of roles now that can be done remotely. And it's also something that we kind of are asked about quite a lot. And I kind of spoke to a few people that we knew to kind of write something for our website about it, just to kind of highlight all of the different types of things you can do. Because we know like loads of different people that live and travel in their van. Some of them are photographers, some of them kind of make like little like wooden spoons and like weave things, like, so whether you're like more kind of creative, I know someone who's like an artist who like illustrates things. You don't need to be doing one sort of job. There's so many different things that you can be doing that kind of can facilitate this lifestyle, I think.
Yeah, that's great advice, that there's many different ways to skin the cat. You can like have a normal job but just work remotely. And there's lots of those going on. Haseen, they have these big lists of like the best digital nomad jobs, so people can go and check those out. There's some like you can do UI and UX checking. So when somebody builds a website, they will get loads of people to use it and like usability studies. So that's one that some people do. I don't think you get paid that much for it now, but if you've got time and you just want a few pennies coming in, you could do something like that. There's also similar things like online surveys, but they tend to be pretty low paid. But I think some of the best advice that I've ever come across is, if it's for when you're making your own business, make something people want. It kind of sounds a bit facetious, but it's actually, I think, the best advice that you can have. So whatever you're doing, it can be like, a lot of the times you can try to fit your skills to the problem, or you could be like, I really want to go away in my van and I'm really good at this, so I'm going to do this. But you really have to think, and I've used this a lot in the past, like, is this really something that somebody wants? I've worked on a few startups in the past, and that's the thing that I've always come back to, and it's kind of the North Star. And so if people are asking you for it, or you're able to do some real customer research beforehand and talk to people, a bit like you did with your survey, but you can do that with your idea. Ideally, you want to get people to pay for it because people will tell you things that might not match how they'd actually part with cash in their wallet. If people are thinking about, well, I'll just ask people if this is a good idea, and people are like, yeah, I'd buy that. And then you actually say, well, go on then. And then they say no. So
yeah.
make something people want. Look at what skills you have and how they intersect with what people want as well. As Derek Sievers has a nice kind of mental model where he talks about it's very difficult to be the best in the world or the top world class, as it's sometimes defined, like in the top 5% of a field. But it's a lot easier to be in the top 5% at, say, like three intersecting fields. So you might know, for me, like I know quite a lot about sustainability, adventure, and then I know quite a lot about marketing and kind of websites and that kind of thing. So I'm not really amazing at any of those, but I kind of have a bit of a more unique position in the intersection of those three things. So where you can think about, where do the three things that I'm best at intersect and what can I offer there? So hopefully useful for people listening, watching, if they're thinking like, I really want to do this, but where should I start? So check those out. All really useful and inspiring stuff. I think I would love to do the van life thing. So you guys are definitely whetting my appetite for that, but we'll see. We haven't really touched on climbing yet, but I'm also a massive keen climber. So I do want to hear a bit about your guys' journey into climbing, climbing escapades. So what was your journey into climbing?
I think my journey started quite young. So I think I was about 7 and got invited on a friend's birthday party at an indoor climbing wall. I think I was marginally better than they were. And I was like, yes, I've finally found a sport that I'm not awful at. And basically immediately signed up for classes and would go twice a week. The next year, I'd go 3 times a week. The year after, 4 times a week. And it's just snowballed and basically taken over my life. So I've been climbing for like 22 years or something like that now.
Wow.
Thankfully, from just climbing inside and now basically exclusively just climb outside.
Yeah. And then for me, it's slightly different. So I kind of started climbing at university, which was a really, really great place to get into it because you just pay like a really tiny amount to join the club. But then there's just this kind of like evolution, I guess, of like all of the older members of the club teach all of the newer members. And then we would go every single fortnight on a trip outside. So we were in Leicester, which is not particularly close to any climbing, but it is in the centre of the country. So every fortnight we would drive to North Wales or Pembroke or the Peak District, kind of all over the place and go climbing. And I actually learned to climb trad climbing, which is like fairly rogue, but kind of a nice way to learn to climb, I think, because easy trad climbing is still really cool, whereas like some super easy sport climbing isn't necessarily as kind of inspiring, but even really easy trad climbs are still kind of really, really cool. So that was a really nice way of learning to climb. Then yeah, it kind of just continued from there. Ever since I finished uni, it's just been every single holiday we went on would be a climbing holiday. And now our life is basically just climbing. Living in a van, climbing and working. So yeah, I think it's pretty good.
That's the dream. What more can you need
really
in life?
Complain.
Yeah. It's climbing's definitely one of those things. It was interesting. I'd kind of seen it from the outside, but never really got into it. I'd been like once or twice when I was younger. And then all of a sudden, I don't know what it was. I think I'd seen somebody showed me like an Adam Ondra video where he's screaming a lot. And I was just like, that guy's a machine. But I didn't really understand, you know, when you watch him do silence, but you have no idea about climbing and you realize why he's screaming so much because no human has ever tried so much at anything ever. But if you haven't done it before, you're just like, oh, he's a bit over the top. And then a friend was like, oh, do you want to just like come and try climbing? I said, yeah, okay, I'll give it a go. And I'd played rugby when I was younger, then I'd done a lot of mixed martial arts, but then got lots of injuries from Thai boxing and things. So I was looking for a new sport and then got into climbing and I kind of wanted something that I could get obsessed with. And I'd seen these people who were climbers, and we'd met quite a few on our cycle tour, and we'd stayed with them, and they were just so stoked on climbing. I was like, I want to be this into climbing. Like, look how excited they are about just going outside. And it definitely got me. Like, it kind of, you get the bug, don't you? And it's yeah, a very, sure. Yeah, it's such an addictive thing. And it's nice to be able to obsess over something kind of healthy like that. But I haven't done loads. I'm only a couple of years in so far. So trad is the, I've tried it once, maybe twice, and it's a different ball game for sure.
Yeah, it's definitely a bit of an experience. I think learning to climb trad climbing was a weird one because I definitely struggle with fear when climbing. And obviously that's like amplified when you go trad climbing because it's not like a bolt below you. It's like a bit of gear that you've put in yourself and that might just ping out. So I think like with kind of all climbing, the more you do, the more comfortable you feel. And so I think typically I now feel fairly comfortable trad climbing just because I've done so much of it. But I think there's a really big thing of just really learning to kind of trust your gear. And like when you're sport, you can have someone that's a really, really good sport climber and they've got mega fitness. But then when they go trad climbing, if you don't know if your gear is going to hold or not, then it makes the whole experience a bit terrifying. So yeah, I think that one of the reasons that I love climbing so much is because there's kind of so many different aspects of it. And it's like a mental thing just as much as a physical thing. So like, it's great that it's physically challenging as someone who's kind of not very sporty, or I was never really into sports. It's like a sport that you can do if you're not a sporty person, which is nice. But then I think it's like the mental aspect of it as well, where you're like constantly problem solving, but then you also have to really challenge yourself to like push yourself mentally. And because I've always kind of struggled with fear, then that's something that I've always been kind of pushing like the whole time I've been climbing, and like slowly like increasing your comfort zone. But it's like this kind of constant journey that you're on to kind of try and increase it, but not so much that you then shrink it again. It's kind of multifaceted, I guess. Yeah.
I think the other good thing about climbing is that I think a lot of sports, you sort of see the lineup of the people that are playing or who's in the race, and they've all got a very similar build. And climbing is like basically totally the opposite. Everyone's a totally different shape. And some people will do really well on one style of routes because of their sort of build, and somebody else will do really well on another one. But crucially, it all kind of averages out, which is really nice. So you don't have to have been born 7 foot tall. It's like everyone's got like a really good chance of sort of doing well in it, really.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually. We were talking about it yesterday at the climbing gym. If you look at the bodies of the like elite climbers, there's probably not another sport with so much differentiation or like dispersion. Like if you look at Magos, who's quite small and thin, but super strong. And he's like, everyone's like, yeah, he's really strong, but he looks like he weighs about 8 stone, but he's just so dense, like really, really unbelievably strong. And then you see bigger guys like Ondra or, which I think is great. Like you say, you just are suited to different problems. Some people are long and stretchy. Some people are strong, but they tend not to be as flexible. So, it keeps it interesting for everyone, which is part of the reason why I love it. So, I saw you doing on your website, you had on your Dometic ad, you had a bit of deep water soloing somewhere.
Yeah.
Shallow water soloing, actually.
Oh, shallow water soloing. Yeah,
not very deep. It transpired.
In the no-fall zone.
Very much so. Yeah, I hit the bottom very hard on that. It was not
like... No way. where was that?
So that was in Scotland on the Isle of Mull. It was a really beautiful spot. So we'd never been there before, and we had this shoot with Dometic, and we knew that we needed to take them somewhere cool, and we were just like leafing through the guidebook, and we found somewhere that looked like it might be interesting, and we said, oh, it'd be really cool if we can go out on our paddle boards and we'll like paddle board out to this like deep water sailing spot, and it'll look really cool. And as we were driving there, we were like, oh no, we've never been here before, we have no idea if there's either going to be like loads of people there or it'll be awful, they won't be able to film it. And then when we got there, it was like, well, firstly, it was the only day it didn't rain in the month that we spent in Scotland.
Nice.
And then we walked kind of about 30 minutes to this beach that was like completely secluded, like beautiful white sand and like clear blue water. And we got there and we like paddled out to the wall, and it was like pretty amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah, pretty idyllic.
Yeah.
The fact that it was like wet and the water wasn't very deep and the climbing was kind of disintegrating a little bit, you didn't really see in the video, which was good. looking back on it, it looked great.
It looked amazing in the video. You didn't see any of the bad bits, so cool.
It was a really beautiful spot, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I think looking on, that is actually the best bit about climbing.
Yeah.
It's just all of the amazing places that
it takes you to.
Get like taken
yeah,
to.
For sure.
Yeah. Any other favorite climbs, top tips, places that you've gone?
I think our default favorite climbing area is. I'm going to say
Pembroke.
Pembroke for the trad.
Pembroke in South Wales is like basically my favorite place in the world. It's just the best and I love it, and we'll be climbing in Spain and I'll be like, oh, this climb makes me feel like I'm in Pembroke. It's like a really ridiculous thing to say. And every so often you'll go to like Loggerout on UKC and all of the comments will be people going, oh yeah, this feels like a Pembroke route. And you're like, oh wow, that's really Brits on holidays. Pembroke for trad is just like the best, because you just get a view of the sea and the climbing's amazing and it's just lovely.
Yeah. And I think for sport climbing or single pitch sport climbing, I think Waterfall Boven in South Africa, just can't beat it in my opinion. Incredible orange rock. Like really nice and high, gently overhanging.
Yeah.
Sort of essentially jungle in the background, howls of monkeys. It's just brilliant.
It's definitely mega. And then I think just like for more European stuff, we really love Siorana in Spain. So when we came out to Spain a couple months ago, that was like where we went first. It's just like so lovely. It's like really like vertical. Kind of crimpy rock, which is like kind of our generally kind of preferred style. And then we've kind of just slowly headed south as it's got a bit colder, so we've been in Chilea for like a month and a half now, which has been really nice, because when we were traveling earlier in the year, it was kind of just as all of the COVID restrictions were easing, and we basically spent like a couple of months like by ourselves because there wasn't really anyone else around. Whereas what's been really nice this time is that there's just so many other people around, and so we've had like really nice van scenes and like a little van life community for the past month and a half, like making group meals with people and hanging out, and it's been really nice to just like have that experience. But I think that will change very quickly soon when we get a ferry over to Albania. I think that will probably get back to being just us for a while.
A lot of contrast, I suspect. Yeah. But it'll be a good adventure.
There's
a little bit of development that's kind of happened there over the last like 3 or 4 years, but overwhelmingly there's absolutely loads of potential and loads of opportunity, basically. Yeah. It just needs someone, or needs people that have got the time to kind of like go and find all of the really good bits, and then hopefully we can like relay that to other people and they can start to head out as well.
Really cool. So is it mainly climbing that you're going to Albania for, to like go and put up some new routes?
So basically the reason that we're going over to Albania is because of Brexit.
I wanted to ask you this.
So this is like the classic point of conversation for everyone living in a van.
Yeah.
But so we kind of spent a while trying to get around it, but in the end, we just decided that we're going to head over to the Balkans for 3 months. So ferry over to Albania, and then we'll head up through kind of like Montenegro and Bosnia up to Croatia. So I don't think we can complain too much.
It is one of the like tenuous like positives, like we were talking about COVID with the positives that you can find out of that. It's the same for Brexit. Like we probably would have never have gone to Albania and the rest of the Balkans.
No, we would have just ended,
staying in Spain, or maybe going down to Morocco. So it's going to be good to kind of like have that like push, like we have to leave Spain
and then do something a lot more adventurous.
Yeah. Yeah, really cool. So for people listening, I don't actually know, what is the rule for now Brexit? I've just got my right to residency in Sweden. Woo! So, nice. So, which was a real battle, but, yeah, that's in the bag now. So, which is very handy, but I kind of am now splitting my time between there and back in the UK. So what are the rules for just kind of like going to Europe now? Is it you're there for 90 days of 180 or what's the jam?
Yeah. So I think 90 and 180 is exactly the situation. Yeah. Providing that you don't have another passport of some description that entitles you to kind of like get around that. So yeah, it's 90 days in, sort of 3 months in Europe, or in the Schengen. Which is a little bit broader than just Europe. And then you have to leave for 3 months and then you can come back in and keep on repeating.
Yeah, but yeah, the weird kind of confusing bit is that it's not actually Europe, it's the Schengen, which includes some countries that aren't in Europe, but there's also some countries that are in Europe that aren't in the Schengen. So like we're gonna go to Croatia, which is in Europe, but that isn't in the Schengen, so it's all very confusing. And then you start having to try and add up all of the days to figure out when you're allowed back in and all this sort of thing. We spent a while kind of having a look at various visa options, but obviously being in a van makes that pretty complicated. Like for pretty much every visa, you need to have a permanent address. So that immediately becomes very complicated. And then it normally also requires you to be kind of either working for a company in a specific country or something like this. So currently the visa situation isn't really possible, but I think what does look good for kind of van lifers in the coming months is that there's a few countries that look to be introducing things that will be useful. So Spain are looking to introduce a kind of like digital nomad visa in the next few months. And we've had a bit of a read into that, and that sounds promising. Yeah. So
I think it's the same for Portugal and Greece as well. I think the world's kind of like catching up to the fact that people want to be able to travel around and keep working at the same time. So, but it has to go through governments and that sort of thing. So inevitably it's quite slow.
Yeah.
But it does look promising for like this year that something definitely might become available.
Yeah, very cool. I have seen some talk about it, and countries know that like the future of work is changing and that digital nomads often get paid okay or even fairly well. So if they're going to keep spending money in the country, then that's probably a good thing. So hopefully there's some developments there and then people can stay on their adventures for a bit longer. Okay. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on, guys. It's been really, really good to chat. Where can people find out more about you? What's the best place to go?
Yep. So it's climbingvan.co.uk and at climbingvan.
Nice and easy.
That's
awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Charlie. Thanks, Dale. Really good to chat. I look forward to catching up again at some point, hearing how your adventure's going. And I'm going to live vicariously and see all the awesome climbs that you're doing. And you can give me some amazing beta out on Eastern Europe and where to go, and some in Spain as well. Actually, I'm going to be out there fairly soon, so I'll look forward following your journey. So yeah, thanks again, Charlie and Dale, and listeners, thanks for tuning in. So until next time, bye bye.
Thanks, bye.
So that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Head over to Call to Adventure, that's T-O, calltoadventure.uk for show notes and more about this episode. You'll also find lots of other free content there. Things like how-to guides and gear reviews, everything to get you out on your next adventure. We've also got loads of adventures for you to join us on in the UK and abroad. We've got things like climbing, hiking, mountaineering, surfing, wild swimming, ski touring, and we're adding new ones all the time, so do take a peek. Each booking helps us fund our green mission, and all international trips are carbon offset. Please do rate and review the show if you're enjoying it. It helps get more people engaged with the outdoors and on board with protecting wild places. Thanks for listening. See you next time.